Good morning. Greetings in the name of Jesus. Happy to be with you all. Glad to see all of you here. Welcome to everyone. Hope you feel at home here today. I'm going to continue this morning in our journey through the book of Matthew. Been preaching, trying to preach one chapter per Sunday that I preach. Matthew 14 brings us to about the midway point of the book. I'm not sure how long I've been at this, but anyway, it seems like it's been a little while. I have been impressed with what I've been learning. I hope y'all are not tired of going through Matthew. Matthew 14 is a shorter chapter, but the lessons that are there for us are perhaps more profound than some of the ones that we've seen earlier. I'm going to go ahead and read the entire chapter this time. Matthew 14, verse 1. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard of the fame of Jesus and said unto his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He is risen from the dead, and therefore mighty works do show forth themselves in him." For Herod had laid hold on John and bound him and put him in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife. For John said unto him, "It is not lawful for thee to have her." And when he would have put him to death, he feared the multitude, because they counted him as a prophet. There's a lot of he's right there and him's, but the he is Herod. And when Herod would have put John the Baptist to death, Herod feared the multitude, is what it's saying there, because the multitude counted John the Baptist as a prophet. But when Herod's birthday was kept, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod. Whereupon he promised with an oath to give her whatsoever she would ask. And she, being before instructed of her mother, said, "Give me here John Baptist's head in a charger." And the king was sorry. Nevertheless, for the oath's sake, and them which sat with him at meat, he commanded it to be given her. And he sent and beheaded John in the prison. And his head was brought in a charger and given to the damsel, and she brought it to her mother. And his disciples came and took the body and buried it and went and told Jesus. When Jesus heard of it, he departed thence by ship into a desert place apart. And when the people had heard thereof, they followed him on foot out of the cities. And Jesus went forth and saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion toward them, and he healed their sick. And when it was evening, his disciples came to him, saying, "This is a desert place, and the time is now past. Send the multitude away, that they may go into the villages and buy themselves victuals." But Jesus said unto them, "They need not depart, give ye them to eat." And they say unto them, unto him, "We have here but 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And he said, "Bring them hither to me." And he commanded the multitude to sit down in the grass, and took the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and brake, and gave the loaves to his disciples, and the disciples to the multitude. And they did all eat, and were filled, and they took up the fragments that remained 12 baskets full. And they that had eaten were about 5,000 men, beside women and children. And straightway Jesus constrained his disciples to get into a ship and to go before him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain apart to pray. And when the evening was come, he was there alone. But the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with waves, for the wind was contrary. And in the 4th watch of the night, Jesus went unto them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a spirit," and they cried out for fear. But straightway Jesus spake to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it be thou, bid me come unto thee on the water." And he said, "Come." And when Peter was come down out of the ship, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him, and said unto him, "O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?" And when they were come into the ship, the wind ceased. Then they that were in the ship came and worshipped him, saying, "Of a truth, thou art the Son of God." And when they had gone over, they came into the land of Gennesaret. And when the men of that place had knowledge of him, they sent out into all that country round about, and brought unto him all that were diseased, and besought him that they might only touch the hem of his garment. And as many as touched were made perfectly whole. All right, we have three distinct episodes here in this chapter. First of all, we have this little story about Herod and John the Baptist. And then that moves into the feeding of the 5,000, and of course into the walking on the water. One of the goals that I set for myself in going through this study was, as you'll remember, to try to bring these chapters to a realistic human imagining if we could be there kind of thing. And the first story, you don't want to imagine too much because there's actually more detail here than the Bible usually gives. But these are people. And I wanted to, I guess I'm a good enough plain Anabaptist that I really like family trees. And I stumbled upon this thing of Herod and his brother Philip. And I was reading about these men and what was going on here. And so if you'll bear with me, I'm going to draw a genealogy up here. And I hope it doesn't bore you to death. But the family tree of these Herods, I'm going to say, is unbelievable. It just is amazing. Now you remember, in Matthew chapter 2, there was a Herod, but he died in verse 19, and that was why Jesus and his parents could come back to Jerusalem or whatever. That was Herod the Great, and I guess I'm going to put him over here. Herod the Great, and he died, but he had five wives. I'm only going to mention four of them. And I'm going to try to make this as straightforward as possible. But he married a woman. I don't know how to say her name. It looks like Mary Omni or something like that, but I'm just going to call her Marianne the First. He also married a Samaritan woman by the name of, I guess you would say, Malface or something like that, in the way I'm used to saying it. He also was married to a woman, same name as the first one, and so we'll call her Marianne the Second. And he also married Cleopatra. Now, I don't know if this is the Cleopatra. Does anybody know? Is that the Egyptian lady? I don't know. But anyway, the first lady up there was the daughter of Hyrcanus, which is interesting if you remember some of the stuff we talked about. But this first lady had a son, and they called him, let's see if I can get my spelling right, Aristobulus. And he married a lady that is known as Bernice. All right. We'll just hang on there for a second. This woman had a child known as Herod, Antipas. This is our Herod today in the story. This is the man that killed John the Baptist. This lady had a son, Herod Philip. Now there was two Herod Philips. This is Herod Philip the First. And this Cleopatra had a son, Herod Philip the Second. Now these are all brothers. Actually, they're half brothers. Okay. Now, this is where things really get confusing. This union was the Herodias' parents. Ready for that? I was not prepared for that one. She married Philip II. No, I'm sorry. Philip I. He married his niece. Right?
It's his brother's, it's his half-brother's daughter that he married. So that now makes her a sister-in-law to these men. All right? These two people together had the daughter. We don't know her name from Scripture, but Josephus gives her name Salome, and that's the girl that danced. Now, Herod visited Philip, fell in love with his wife. Herod Antipas was originally married to the daughter of a king of Nabatea, I believe. And he divorced her and married this lady. So now he is married to his niece and to his sister-in-law. And this man marries Salome. Isn't that crazy? But the Bible doesn't do this for us, and I'm relying on secondary historical sources. I can't go read the originals. But start thinking about what Salome was to Herod Antipas. He was what? She would have been a grandniece based on this relationship. She would have been a niece based on this relationship and a stepdaughter based on this relationship. All I'm trying to do here is I'm not even really trying to prove any point other than I'm trying to help us understand when John the Baptist says it is not lawful for thee to have her, he may have meant more than just that's your brother's wife. He may have meant a lot more than that. The other thing that this proves is that Herod and his family were very sad people. And again, all I'm doing is trying to show the human element of these people. They were people, and they had relationships, family relationships. So we learn from all of this that apparently Herod was a very lustful, weak-willed man. We learn that Herodias was a wicked, scheming lady. We learn that Salome was beautiful and probably very sensual, and also under the training of her mother. And putting all of these things together, we find that it is a very bad place to be if you're a righteous person. Because John the Baptist was there, and it vexed him, and he told the truth about the relationship, and it eventually cost him his head. Now, the thing that I find interesting is that for some reason, Herod kind of liked John the Baptist. You'll notice that. In verse 9, it says the king was sorry. Now, I don't know if he was sorry because he liked him. I think that might be part of it. But it may have been back in verse 5. It says that he was scared to put him to death because the multitude counted him as a prophet. Maybe he was sorry because it was going to cost him some political capital. I don't know. It could be either one. But either way, he didn't really want to kill John the Baptist. But he ended up having it done to keep a promise that he made while under the influence of lust and alcohol, most likely. We're going to learn a lot of things from that story, but we'll hold on to that for now. Let's go down now to the story of feeding of the 5,000. Immediately after this, Jesus is going away, but there's this crowd of people that find out where he is, and they follow him out of the city. Now, I never spent a lot of time trying to figure out where these people came from, but when you stop and think about how many people this really was, go down to verse 21. It says that the people that ate were about 5,000 men beside women and children, and I guess that that's a correct translation. That means that there were probably somewhere to the tune of 15,000 people there. That would be what I would read there. Now, where did all these people come from? Well, in reading this and piecing together some of the other passages from the other Gospels, it seems like this would have been time of the Passover, and so a lot of people were traveling. And so when they see Jesus, they're immediately attracted and they want to go listen to him. So that's how you could get these huge crowds. Because 15,000 people, I believe that would empty out Tylertown, possibly even Columbia, right? I didn't check the population statistics on that. But the point is, getting that many people together in one spot, just at the snap of your finger, is a little bit difficult. But it makes sense if it fits in with a Passover journey. People traveling to Jerusalem, they're headed back home, they see Jesus. Oh, well, let's go listen to Jesus. It also might explain why provisions were a little bit low. Now, I did a little calculating. I was inspired to do this by Justin's devotions the other night about the pigs and how long of a line the pigs would have made. But do you know what modern crowd estimates are? That whenever you're trying to do crowd control, you should allow 4.5 to 5 square feet per person. That's what modern estimates are. If you want to build a church big enough to hold your huge congregation, 4.5 to 5 square feet per person. Well, if you take that times 15,000 or even 10,000, you're going to get somewhere around 1 acre to 2 acres of land that this is going to cover. Now, it doesn't sound like much, but that's little squares of 4.5 square feet per person. That's huge. That's a big crowd. And that's packed in. That's not allowing for any aisles down through there either. So it's really no wonder when the disciples saw this, they said, well, send them away and they're going to have to go buy their own food. And Jesus says, no, you give them some food to eat. And they're like, what are we going to do here? We only have 5 loaves and 2 fish. Well, we know what Jesus was able to do with that, and he fed everybody. Well, immediately after that, according to the scripture, verse 22, straightway, immediately, Jesus told his disciples to get into a ship, and he was going to send the multitudes away while they went across the sea, which did two things. It left Jesus alone to pray, and it also gave him an opportunity to come to them in a very unusual way. I've never been in a boat when it was stormy, especially not in the night, but I suppose that if I were, I would be pretty scared to see somebody walking through the waves too. I really don't fault these disciples for that at all. And then Jesus says who he is, and Peter is immediately ready to run to him on the water. Peter knew that there was no island under him. And he does it. But it isn't very long until he realizes that he is about to die. And he utters the shortest prayer of the Bible. And he is prayed. I mean, he is saved by his prayer. Jesus and Peter then get safely into the ship, and Jesus calms the storm. And then the last 3 verses of the chapter we have that Jesus landed in the land of Gennesaret, and many people were there wanting to get healed. And this is possibly the same place that the pigs drowned, but there is a little discrepancy there when you look at maps and that sort of thing. Possibly not the same place, but it might be. Okay, well, hopefully we've been able to kind of put ourselves into the human element of this, and then we can see better, perhaps, the divine element of Jesus Christ if we can picture ourselves being there. What are some things that we can learn, some practical things that perhaps we can take home and ponder from each one of these stories? Well, backing up to the first story of the killing of John the Baptist, I suppose there would be 3 or 4 messages that could be preached from this, focusing on each character in this, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to just pick some things out that impressed me the most, probably. First of all, I have labeled Herod as a lustful, weak-willed man. And the lesson that I want us to learn, especially as men, that probably these two adjectives go hand in hand. that lustful men are weak-willed and weak-willed men are lustful, perhaps. And the reason I say he's weak-willed is because he was not able to say no to a demand of this wicked woman to kill John the Baptist. Now, he did swear an oath, and he probably thought there was some honor in keeping that oath, but I noticed there's another detail that Matthew gives us, and it says that it was for his oath's sake and also for them that sat with him at meat. He was in a bind because he was scared of the population. He was scared of the people that counted John the Baptist as a prophet, but he was also scared of the people that were sitting right around the table with him that heard him say that. And he was probably thinking this whole thing through the best that a drunk man can, and he was thinking, you know, I can't go back on my word because all of these people are listening. And so you have this whole thing just kind of snowballing on him. But the whole thing, in my mind, could have been avoided if he would have never gone after Herodias in the first place, which was a lustful decision to make. But he did. Anyway. So that's lesson number one, that the poison of lust will erode away at a man's ability to make sound decisions, and he will become putty in the hands of these ladies. Which takes me to the second lesson that we can learn, and this is going by what I know about Herodias. She was a very wicked woman. There was probably one other woman in the Bible at least as wicked, perhaps more wicked than she, and that is Jezebel. And so the lesson for the ladies this morning is that women can be extremely controlling and manipulative. Now you say, well, that's only wicked women. Well, that's probably true. But are wicked women controlling and manipulative because they're wicked, or are they wicked because they're controlling and manipulative? Now, it sounds kind of like circular reasoning. It wasn't meant to be. My point is that as ladies, you need to be very careful with your potential to be that way. Because if you happen to be close to lustful, weak-willed men, you will be able to do whatever you want to with them. And maybe that sounds like something that's appealing to you. I hope not. And I'm going to submit that you do not have to be intentionally wicked to be that way. But look at the damage that these women could accomplish. You think about Jezebel, think about Herodias. I lump them into the same boat. They're about equal in my mind, as far as place of influence, as far as how they influence them. Point number three, something we can learn from this story. I'm going to read it to you the way I have it written. Listen carefully. I did this on purpose. Bad things happen to good people at the hands of bad people, even when good people are doing good things. Bad things happen to good people at the hands of bad people, even when good people are doing good things. That's John the Baptist. What was he doing wrong fundamentally? Absolutely nothing. What was Herod doing right fundamentally? Very little. And yet God, for some reason, allows these things to happen. And I am not up to the task of explaining why. I have no idea. It's kind of like I was thinking in Sunday school this morning. Why does God allow offenses to come? If it's such a terrible thing, why does he even permit people to do those things? Well, it's completely out of my ability to explain. And yet we see it here. We do not see God coming down with lightning and thunder and getting John out of prison before he could be beheaded, or even quietly in the middle of the night like he did with Peter. And why did he let Peter go? I don't know. When we begin to ask why questions about these kinds of situations, we suddenly get into a realization that God is much bigger and can see more than we can ever see. And John the Baptist died at the hands of Herod. That's just the way it is.
The next sub-lesson on that point is that when we find ourselves in a situation where bad things are apparently happening to us, number one, it doesn't automatically make us a good person. Okay, that's one lesson that we might could warp a little bit. But we shouldn't ever assume that. That's just because it is. But we should remember that just because bad things are happening to us does not mean that we're doing bad things either. There's so many things that you could pull from this when you think about what God allows to happen. We do not need to try to figure it all out. Neither do I think we should just sit there and say, oh, well, what is, and be fatalistic about it. There'd be nothing wrong with analyzing our lives when we see bad things happening. But these kind of stories should give us courage that sometimes bad people are in charge, and there's really not a whole lot a righteous person can do about it. Okay, number four. Herodias hated John the Baptist because he spoke some truth about her relationship. I don't know if Herod would have killed him on his own. It doesn't seem like it. It seems like it had to come from the scheming of Herodias. But the lesson that we need to learn here is that killing the messenger is a way to keep from hearing the truth. We have that choice. And there's many ways we can silence the messenger. We would probably never physically kill somebody, but we can damage them to the point that nobody will listen to what they say. And we can do all kinds of things, because sometimes truth is extremely inconvenient. And in this case, it was. But the lesson we can learn is that it's a way to keep from hearing the truth. It's not the way to solve the problem of hearing truth, and it won't keep us permanently away from truth, because God will always speak to us in some way or another. Another lesson that we could possibly learn from this, I'm not sure if it applies to us, but it might, and that is that truth can come from surprising sources. I don't know if Herod expected to hear truth from John the Baptist. I don't know what he knew about John the Baptist. But you know, if you were in Herod's shoes and you had the power to put somebody into prison and he was the one speaking truth to you, it would be easy to say, well, he's just an old prophet. He's just a guy that runs around in the wilderness preaching. We can discount truth. The lesson that I'm getting there is that we can discount truth because of who brings it to us. Lesson number five from this story is that making a promise should never be done rashly. Now, we know that, don't we? And we would never be in the situation where Herod was, would we? Well, probably not exactly. But I can imagine that there would be times and places that we would be under the influence of our desires, under the influence of whatever it is, and we make promises that later we wish we wouldn't have. It could be something as simple as making a lot of money or whatever it is, and so you make a promise to do something and later you wish you wouldn't have. Promises should never be made rashly. Ever. That goes for
simple little promises about what time you're going to be at a certain place, all the way down to baptismal vows and wedding vows. Never think that we can just keep everything that we say. And then when we do promise, it is with all of our reason intact. Let's move to the next story. Feeding of the 5,000. In the next two stories, the feeding of the 5,000 and walking on the water, I find it interesting that almost every miracle that happens, you can see a salvation motif through the whole thing. There's this projection of what the divine can do for humanity that would never have happened otherwise. And in this case of the feeding of the 5,000, we see the salvation of a multitude. We have a needy, hungry crowd. We have no provisions of their own that can do it. They might have a little bit, but five loaves and two fish aren't going to do it. We see that Jesus can meet all the needs of everybody. There's some left over. Jesus fed them all. So the lessons that we can learn from that are just those, that Jesus is able to take the tiny little bit that we're, whatever it is that we have, and he can make it into something that will be helpful to many, many people. Jesus can meet all the needs of everybody, and there is some left over, as it were. The second thing that I want to get from this story, this doesn't tell us about the little boy, but in another gospel we see that it was a little boy that had the food. And the lesson I want to get from that is that the little boy had to give his whole lunch. I have wondered already what would have happened if the little lad would have said, well, I want half a fish and two loaves, or one loaf, and then you can have the rest. Now, Jesus could have done it with that too. He could have done it with nothing. He could have just brought it out of thin air, okay? I understand that. But I believe there's something here for us to learn. When we look at someone giving it all up, the widow gave two mites. It was all she had. Jesus can do way more with all that we have than with what half of what we have. I don't know if I'm making any sense there, but that is something that is true all through this life of faith. When we live a life of faith, we give it all up, and Jesus does wonderful things with what we give. If we try to keep a little bit, we end up losing it. And that takes us to the next point. I kind of lapped these two together, but number three, Jesus had time for people even when it seemed like he wanted time for himself. I don't know. Matthew writes the story so that it sounds like when Jesus heard about John the Baptist being killed in such a horrible way, that he wanted to just get away and think about it, I guess. Probably because he knew that a similar fate waited him. But when he saw the people, he stopped and said, you know what, we're going to take time for these people even before I take time for myself. And kind of lumping that in with the thing that we talked about earlier about giving all that we have. I have come to understand and apply the verses. We talked about this a little bit, about losing and saving our lives. Remember, we talked about it in Bible school class. What does it mean to lose our lives? Well, I've come to apply this idea in this sense, that when I begin to try to protect my interests, my family, my money, my time, when I try to protect it from true service, I end up finding that my family and my time and my money and my interests don't fill the need that I need filled. That it would have been better to go ahead and give the time, give the money, give the family, whatever it is. That whole protectionism ends up destroying the very thing that we're trying to protect. And that's what I think Jesus is teaching us here. He had time for the people, even though he really probably needed time for himself. And we have this story about 5,000 people getting food. The next story, Jesus walking on the water, and Peter walking on the water, for that matter. Again, there's a salvation motif there. We see helpless men trying desperately to save themselves against huge odds, and they're not succeeding. And then Jesus comes, and he's completely in control, 100%. He can walk on top of an element that none of us would dare walk on top of. If I told you to walk on top of the lake, you would say, you are crazy. It doesn't work. Well, actually, it does. Jesus did it. And he's completely in control of the situation. He can walk right over the waves. Just, I kind of picture him going up and down over the little hills, over the big hills. And he doesn't calm the storm until he's in the boat. Is there any lessons for us in that? Perhaps there is. Another thing that we can learn from this, I don't know which number I'm on. If you're taking notes, it might be 3 or 4 by now. Take this how I mean it, but it is safe to walk on the water when Jesus tells us to. There's a couple things that I don't want you to take from that. First of all, don't take from that you can launch out onto a crazy expedition because somehow, somewhere, you heard a voice telling you to do it. It's not what we're talking about. But there are times when an act of faith is about like walking on the water. And we're pretty sure that as soon as we step out of the boat, we're going to sink. And lo and behold, we don't. Another thing that we should learn from this is that Peter should be commended for his willingness to walk on the water. Yes, he sank, but he was the only one that got out of the boat. And so we learn here that obedience is important. Jesus said, come, and Peter came. The next thing that we should commend Peter for is his prayer to Jesus. Very short prayer, shortest one in the Bible that I'm aware of. Lord, save me. And isn't that the prayer that every one of us has to pray at some point? Maybe multiple points in our lives. We should commend Peter for his prayer of salvation. And the last lesson that I want to learn from this passage on the water is that the storms of life, the storms of sin, the storms of anything you can imagine are calmed at the voice of Jesus. He said, well, he didn't even say anything this time. He climbed into the boat. I thought he rebuked the wind this time, but he didn't. He just climbed into the boat and the wind immediately stopped. Verse 32. The presence of Jesus, the voice of Jesus, will calm every storm that we face. The last little passage there, the last three verses that talk about Jesus healing all the people there, I simply want to just pull one thing from that, and that comes from verse 36. And that is that phrase, perfectly whole. When Jesus heals, it is complete. And I believe that these miracles, again, were pointing forward to a complete spiritual healing because obviously all of these people that he healed eventually died. The healing was for time, for their lifetime, whatever. But when we are healed spiritually, when Jesus comes into our ship, as it were, or we touch his garment, whatever phraseology you want to use there, the healing is going to be 100% spiritual healing. In conclusion, these passages show us again Matthew's writing. He's showing his fellow Jews that Jesus is indeed the Son of God, and he is still the Son of God, and he is still ready, he is still able, and he is still willing to help every one of us. Let's kneel for prayer.